This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The space agency NASA recently celebrated the crash of one of its space probes. And while that may sound odd, in this case, the smashing of an orbiter called Messenger into the planet Mercury was long planned, and the mission itself was labeled a big success. Messenger was launched 11 years ago. It was the first probe to circle around Mercury ever, and before its death in April, had sent back almost 300,000 images of the planet closest to our sun, and revealing facts about Mercury on its atmosphere and its poles. Messenger was but one of several vehicles flying far out into our solar system these days, showing us images never seen before, from Mars to Pluto. Today in The Exchange, our sky guys have landed, not crashed, into our studios with an update of the latest in astronomy news, and let's hear from you too. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our sky guys are Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center. Mal, glad you landed in safely this morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It was a nice, soft landing.
John Gianforte is also here, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and astronomy instructor for UNH and Granite State College. John, great to see you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome, Laura. Glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about Messenger. And first of all, John, why Mercury? Everybody these days seems interested in Mars. We'll talk about Jupiter's moon Europa. Lots of interest there. But Mercury doesn't really get a lot of attention.
Well, it's a kind of an elusive planet. It's a difficult planet to see, so it's not in the public eye very often. It's an inner planet, so it never gets very far from the sun. That makes it difficult to see in our sky. It's always very close to the sun. In a twilight sky, either in the morning or in the evening sky. So it doesn't get a lot of press. But Mercury is a terrestrial planet, like the Earth, Mars, and Venus. So when we learn about other terrestrial planets, we learn more about our own planet. And Mercury was interesting because it's the innermost planet. It is just a tad less dense than the Earth. And Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. And Mercury has a lot of weird characteristics. It has a really huge core. Terrestrial planets are differentiated, which means they have a core, a mantle, and a crust. So we want to learn more about Mercury so we can learn more about the other terrestrial planets as well as the Earth. And one of the things we found that Messenger confirmed at Mercury was that there are deposits of water ice at the poles of Mercury down deep in craters that never are exposed to sunlight.
Which is kind of interesting because Mercury is so close to the sun. You'd think that any water would be, you know, boiling.
Nope, nobody would have ever thought that there would be water on the innermost planet. You're right.
So studying Mercury, John, and any rocky planet gives us better clues to our own past than studying a gas giant like, you know, Neptune.
Well, there's other reasons to study other planets that formed elsewhere in the solar system. But terrestrial planets have a special place because the Earth is a terrestrial planet. And where we can learn more about our own planet, that makes good sense.
Were there any images from the crash, John, given how fast the probe was going? You know, that could have been an amazing picture.
It would have been great to witness that. But the spacecraft was traveling at 8,700 miles per hour when it crashed. And because Messenger was the only spacecraft ever to orbit Mercury, there was no one there to witness it.
Wow. What do you think of all this, Mal? Finally, Mercury gets some needed attention, according to John.
Right. It was an interesting probe because, first of all, it was the first spacecraft to actually orbit Mercury. In the past, we've had a few flybys of Mercury, and that was more like a direct flyby, get a picture of part of the surface of Mercury, and that's really all we knew about it. The real gold mine, in a sense, of what we got of information from the MESSENGER mission is that being an orbiting spacecraft, it was able to map the entire planet. So we now have the most complete map of Mercury than we had before that. And everybody wonders about, you know, these names, MESSENGER. Of course, we think of Mercury being the god messenger with the winged feet going, or, you know, fleet-footed Mercury.
Which goes around the sun quickly. Okay, that makes sense.
It seems like they had to force that word. I love these acronyms they come up with. If you look at where they get the name, the word messenger actually is sort of an acronym that means the Mercury Surface Space Environment Geochemistry and Ranging Mission.
That's a stretch.
It just kind of rolls off the tongue there.
But what's cool, you're saying, Mal, is that, you know, we've had flybys before where they snap a couple pictures, if I could put it that way. But this messenger was in orbit for a long time and told us a ton.
And from an engineering point of view, though, just the fact that they were able to get it to go into orbit, it was not easy to do. It took them years of many flybys. They did a few flybys beforehand, before they actually orbited. And they had to kind of sneak up on it because the actual probe itself had a sun shield. You have to keep that side facing the sun all the time because, as you say, Mercury is very hot and you don't want to get in the way of that sun. You need to protect the equipment, the actual sensors of the probe. So it has to have a shield always facing the sun. So it's got this weird configuration where one side's always facing the sun. And then as Mercury goes around the sun, because it has a very slow rotation to it, you're going to have just little snippets of more and more information. Every time it goes over Mercury, it'll be a slightly different part than what it flew over before. So that's how they do it over the years.
Hey, Mal, that sunshade you mentioned is one of the huge positive spinoffs of the Mercury mission, messenger mission, because it was so effective at shielding the instrumentation on messenger from the 300-degree temperature that the operating temperature of the instruments inside messenger was only room temperature.
Wow, that's amazing.
Wow, that's right.
So they're going to use that on future missions.
Sure, and probably some applications here on Earth.
Absolutely.
Again, our sky guys have landed in our studios today. We're getting an update on some of the big astronomy stories of the past few weeks, and you can join us with your questions and comments. We'd love to hear from you this hour. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Mal Cameron, John Gianforte, let's go to our listeners. Steve's joining us from Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
One of the high points of my life was in 1969 when we landed on the moon. And I was at San Juan Island in the state of Washington. And it's a very simple question. We know, why don't we stop going back to the moon? I want to go back to the moon anyway, so why?
Steve, it's a great question. And Mal, one we've talked about on this program before. Go ahead.
Thanks for calling in, Steve. It turns out that I know who Steve is. We're pretty good friends. And he's asked me this question before. We've had this debate for a while, haven't we, Steve? But there are plans on the books eventually to use. There have been plans to have moon bases set up. And it's not just us. Even the Chinese, I believe, are planning to put a moon base up there at some point. I think we will eventually get there, but our mind is all set, I think, on let's go to Mars. That seems to be the more fantastical journey that everybody seems to want to take. After the messenger mission, I don't think anybody wants to go to Mercury. not much going on there.
Mercury scientists do.
Mercury scientists do.
Right. Well, but this is interesting, and we're definitely going to spend part of our next segment talking about Mars and that Mars One, I don't know what to call it. It's not a mission yet, but project to get people on a one-way trip to Mars. So I'd love to hear from listeners on that. Would you go? if you were invited to. But why not the moon? Is anybody, John, seriously planning about going back there, or has that sort of been there, done that?
Well, the Russians and the Chinese are talking about going back to the moon. And the Chinese, just a year and a half ago, launched a rover to the moon, the Jade Rabbit, which was somewhat successful. It had some engineering problems on the surface, but it did send back data. It did prove out some technology for the Chinese.
Okay, so I didn't know that. There's a Chinese rover up there now.
Yes.
They're not going to disrupt those famous American footprints, I hope.
No. They're on in a different location on
the
moon. They were able to find a parking place with not a lot of space.
Yeah. So why would the Russians and the Chinese send astronauts to the moon? What would they learn, uncover that we didn't back in the 60s and 70s?
Well, as it turns out, we brought back 842 pounds of moon rocks. And we thought we knew everything about the moon, or most of the things about the moon, in 1972 when the last mission left. But since then, we've reanalyzed a lot of those old lunar samples and found that a lot of what we thought we knew about the moon isn't true.
Oh.
So there are some things to learn about the moon. A lot of things we learned since 72 have raised some doubts, or at least some questions, about the theory that explains the origin of the moon. So there's still a lot to learn from the moon, but it's not as romantic or as sexy as going to Mars, because if we're looking for water and we're looking for life, it's probably not on the moon, it's on Mars.
Well, so here's an email that came in. Steve, thank you for that question. Bob emails us from Kittery, Maine. He says, I've long wondered what the Earth/moon system would look like from deep space, for example, from Mars. How far apart would they appear? What would be the apparent magnitude of the two bodies? Also, would they ever occult each other? If so, how often? Bob says, I have often noted that in pictures of the solar system, the moon is omitted. Lots of great questions, Bob. Thank you. Mal, just generally, what would the Earth and moon system look like from way, way out?
Well, it would be a blue dot would be the Earth, and it would be a brighter than the moon would look, because the moon is a quarter the diameter of the Earth. I'm thinking about the occult question. That's an interesting one. My understanding is, because of the alignment of the orbits of Earth and Mars, that the moon would actually be bobbing up and down as it orbits around the Earth, because the orbit of the moon is tilted slightly, about, 5 degrees, I think, John? And so you might see it a little bit higher than the other dot, and the other a little bit lower. There would be a point, though, I would think, if the timing is right, where it would actually go across and cross Earth, which would be kind of interesting to see.
All right, Bob, thank you for that email. And coming up, we will turn to Earth's closest neighbor, Mars. A new lander is headed for the red planet, and we'll hear about some serious efforts by a European entrepreneur to colonize Mars, with people signing up already for that one-way trip. We'll find out more. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy with our Sky Guys today, catching up on the latest in astronomy. And gentlemen, let's talk about Mars. But before we turn to Mars One, this is a European company that is already signing folks up who want to colonize the red planet. Let's talk about what they might find when they arrive. By the way, Exchange listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Let's get your thoughts in on this, your questions about Mars, your comments about whether you would go, if asked, a one-way trip to the red planet. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. And John, so just a little bit. There are folks planning to take that trip. We'll talk in a minute about the feasibility. But what do we know about Mars that we didn't know 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, thanks to all these rovers that have been scooting around for gosh, years now?
It's getting pretty crowded on Mars. There's several orbiting space platforms. There's two active missions on Mars right now. The Mars Curiosity rover that landed in August of 2012 with a specific goal in mind to determine if Mars ever presented a habitable environment for life, or perhaps has one now. And it has already answered the question that Mars did present a habitable environment for life. It doesn't mean it found little bugs crawling around or aliens on the surface, but it found low-level organic compounds. It found some it certainly found ample evidence of a warmer, wetter period on Mars. And several of the missions have confirmed that there is not a question that there's lots of water on Mars. No liquid water, but just underneath the surface in certain areas, large areas of the planet, there is pure water ice.
How do we know it was warmer, John? That's intriguing.
Well, we have seen evidence of dried riverbeds, waves and dunes that we and off of some of the large impact craters, we see like drainage gullies leading down to the bottom of the crater. Now, those could be caused by rocks rolling down the crater walls or wind, but a lot of the chemical results from the Mars exploration rovers and from Curiosity, the new rover, the SUV-sized rover that's been on Mars for 2 years.
Oh, that's how big it is?
Wow. That's how big it is. Mm-hmm. That has confirmed that the clay analysis of the clays that were found by drilling into rock found that there was a time on Mars where there was ample standing liquid water almost all over the planet.
Wow.
And that's huge. So we no longer say, well, I wonder if it was warmer and wetter. It was.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is you remember, way back when people looked at Mars just from here on Earth, there was a guy who saw evidence of canals on Mars, remember?
And yes, Schiaparelli.
Yeah, right. And he said, there's canals and there must be an intelligent sort of Venetian city there.
Right? Well, he used the word canali, which simply means in Italian, channel.
Uh-huh.
But it was the media in the United States that translated that incorrectly into the word canal that implied an intelligent origin for those channels.
I see. Okay, so Mal, let's talk a little bit about Mars One. And just to give the audience a little background, this is a project by a Dutch entrepreneur to get a team together he calls the Mars 100, meeting next spring for team exercises and training. So this is happening. And then he's going to whittle this group of 100 down to 24 trainees. Is this for real?
It is for him, and it is for a lot of people. If you go to his website, the Mars-1.com is where you want to go, and you can check it out. And it has testimonials from all different people who are willing to go to Mars and not want to come back.
A one-way trip.
There's a lot of logistics that have to be handled, as you've probably discovered as well. The man's name is Bas Lansdorp, and he's a Dutchman who came up with this idea. They started out with a few thousand people and wheedled it down, as you said, now to 100 candidates who are willing to go. The idea is that they want to send in advance of those people. They don't just want to send them there with backpacks and say, hey, good luck. But that would be the worst field trip ever, I guess. Says, oh, you mean we're not? Oh, darn. I should have brought the extra granola bar.
Right.
But they're going to be sending, I think it's 6 or 7 different missions ahead of time. Now, here's the real funky part. You've got to get those people to go, the equipment to land and assemble without real people using robots.
Right. The plan is to send, I don't know, 4 or 6 rockets with all sorts of stuff to build a place for them to live.
And build multiple habitat. There's a picture on the website of it.
I have robots doing that.
And robots are going to assemble this.
Those are pretty smart robots.
Very smart robots. And you really have to trust your robots if you're going to go and live there beforehand. Oh, yeah, sure. We turned on the oxygen for you. No problem. But my thinking is, look what the difficulty is, the degree of difficulty that's involved in getting something to Mars in the first place. Now, we're getting very good at it and getting better and more precise. But when you go out in the night sky and you look at this little red dot of Mars out there, and you know that it's tens of millions of miles away from you, and figure initially back in the 1970s, for example, that they could actually get a space probe to go there in orbit and land, but it's kind of like taking potluck of where you're going to land. They can get a rocket today. I mean, the latest Curiosity, when it landed, there is what it's called a landing ellipse that they project on the surface of Mars and say, we want to land it within somewhere within that ellipse. Now, the initial landing ellipses were quite large because they weren't that precise. But when they sent Curiosity up there, that really narrowed things down. It was a very tiny ellipse. Here you have a case where you've got six landings you want to do, and all in the same ellipse.
Right, so the robots within,
within distance
together,
of each other, so that you could see the next one over there that you, okay, I got to bring that unit over here. And you don't want them to be a long distance apart from each other. So you got to really, that's got to be major technology.
Well, in order to land the Curiosity rover, which was the size of an SUV on Mars, they had to come up with a completely new, radically different engineering concept to get a payload that big to land softly on Mars.
Because, 7 minutes of terror.
Right, because Mars has an atmosphere, but it's not enough atmosphere to slow a spacecraft down during reentry. So you have to develop a concept that takes something as big as a manned mission. Right now, the technology does exist. We don't know how to land a very massive vehicle on Mars safely. We don't know how to do that. So that technology doesn't exist today.
Well, I definitely want to ask you guys more about this, but reminding our listeners that you too can join us with your thoughts on this idea of a group of folks that are indeed signing up for a one-way trip to Mars. This is happening already. What do you think of this? Would you consider going? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So I want to hear from both of you on this. But you first, John, please. You know, it's so easy to look at this mission and go, well, it wouldn't work because of, you know, you can't land something this big. And what would people breathe? And what would they eat? And how about those robots who are setting up your tent, so to speak, before you get there? But what about the idea, John, that you know, it's easy to say we can't, but at some point, smart people do get together and figure things out. Look at the moon.
You're so right. And I'm certainly not against the mission, but I want to make sure the details are worked out before we go. Because once you decide to go and you're on your way or you're there, you can't come back. And that's a one-way mission is a different concept from what most Americans think about space or about, you know, human space exploration.
Sure, it's kind of creepy.
It is. And what's to stop people from, after being there for a couple of years, something catastrophic happening or they all want to come home? Do you just turn your back on them? What if the reality TV show that's supposed to fund this goes off the air? Where is the money going to come from? So those are considerations. I mean, there's a lot of technical reasons to say, don't go. But what he's done is people are talking. That's generating interest in the public. He's got sponsors for the mission, which is all good for the science and the exploration of outer space. So there's a lot of positive aspects for this, but we have to proceed with caution. It's proceed with caution.
Well, sure. And let's take some calls on this. And I have another question for you too, Mal.
Okay.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Dan's joining us from Amherst. Hi, Dan. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi there. Just a quick question. I'd like to bring you guys back to the moon. It's easy to talk about going to the Mars, but we don't have the technology to get there. With regards to setting up a colony, it always seems to make more sense to start in our own backyard and set a goal to put a colony, a base, whatever you want to call it, on the moon and see if we can live there for a couple of years. We've only ever had people in space in weightlessness, microgravity, for a year and a half. So we don't know the long-term effects of low gravity, so why not spend it with a 1/6 gravity for a couple of years before we try to go off to Mars?
Wow, Dan, interesting idea. What do you think? So hold off on this Mars mission, folks. Colonize the moon for a little while, see how it goes, see what problems you have. If you have a big problem, you can always jet back. It only takes 3 days. What do you think, Mal?
It's a very interesting idea, Dan. Thanks for calling in. You got me thinking here. One thing about being on the moon is the fact that you'll always have your home, your original home, in sight all the time. And that there's a psychological thing about that, too. And as Laura just said, you're like 3 days away. If you have an emergency on the moon and you need to send supplies, or someone gets really ill and you need to get them home,
you could walk there.
You could walk there, right.
You don't want to miss Grandma's birthday party.
Well, John could walk there. But,
but it is an interesting point. If there are all these technological concerns and what ifs, why not try it on the moon first?
Yeah. And that's another interesting, the psychological aspect is an interesting point of being on Mars, because Mars being further away from the sun than the Earth is actually traveling faster around the sun, and there'll be a point where your home planet that you came from will disappear from view.
Wow.
And that could have a psychological problem on Mars as well.
Well, like right now, the whole month of June, Mars is in conjunction with the sun. I mean, it's on the far side of the sun. So we can't communicate with any of the spacecraft at Mars, so for a 3 week period. So because the sun interferes with radio communications, so there's no experimentation going on with Curiosity. It's parked in a safe place with its robotic arm stowed for the next 3 weeks until Mars gets out of the sun's glare and we can resume normal communications.
Oh, that's interesting. So this is when that whole Curiosity team at NASA probably takes a vacation, right? Because you can't communicate with the rover anyway.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dan, for the call. And to where? And David is on the air. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Good morning. Always glad to hear from you. Glad to call again and got in. I have a technical question associated with landing on Mars. I was curious about the possibility of considering previous, you know, or advanced drops of a system that could deploy, say, inflatable either nitrogen. I don't know if that would float in the atmosphere for Mars, but if you had to go as far as helium, something so that you could deploy a large net scenario to slow things down, or, you know, something that, like a catch net you could pitch at it, you know?
Okay, so it's got us thinking. This is what kind of what we talked about before, John. You know, it's easy to say, no, 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 we can't do it because of X, Y, Z, but people like David are saying, okay, well, what about this?
That's exactly the thought process that's taking place and has to take place to develop new out-of-the-box thinking on how to get a large payload safely to the surface. And that's a good idea, David. I mean, it's important to consider different things like the sky crane maneuver that landed Curiosity to the surface, which when you looked at it, you said, there's no way that's going to work. As an engineer, I said, wow. I mean, first of all, what were they dreaming or what were they drinking when they thought of that idea? And then, but they executed it flawlessly. From, you know, 100 million miles away successfully, that taught us something. So definitely out-of-the-box ideas are going to be needed to get these eight spacecraft in advance of the human mission to Mars, if that ever takes place.
And that goes back to when they first landed the little rover called Pathfinder in the 90s. And they said, how are we going to get this thing down on the planet? And somebody said, I know, let's surround it by airbags and we'll just drop it and let it bounce around. And everybody went, what?
I remember that.
Yeah. And of course, they did
worked.
The same thing later on with larger airbags when they dropped the two Spirit and Opportunity back in 2004. And so, you know, all these crazy ideas and of course, the latest one, the sky crane idea. Oh, we're just going to hover and drop this one-ton unit down on a tether, and once it hits the ground, then we'll break the bonds, and then that
this is from Mars
fly
One.
Away. Mars One. No,
Curiosity.
This is Curiosity.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's what they did. This is the sky crane that John was referring to.
Got it. Okay.
If you're unfamiliar with that, just Google Curiosity's 7 Minutes of Terror.
It's a great video.
It'll take you to a YouTube site.
Right.
And it's an unbelievable 7-minute video. Very informative, very fun to watch, and very exciting. It's like you're right there.
Here's one more question on this, and then there's a couple other missions that I want to catch up on with you guys. You talked about out-of-the-box thinking. Another out-of-the-box thinking surrounding this Mars One is the way it would be funded. Space agencies run by governments just aren't going to fund this level of investment that would be needed. So the idea of the guy running this thing is to make it a reality TV show, right? And that, you know, 7-8 billion pairs of eyeballs will be watching this thing. I mean, people will be wanting to watch this. And so obviously the opportunity to make a lot of money through advertising is there. But here's what somebody from NASA, there's this great article in The Guardian that we've put on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, looking at this critically, not saying no way, but looking at it critically. And the reporter interviewed a NASA insider who said, "Look, I support any initiative that's trying to get to Mars, and I wish them nothing but the best. Their business plan, selling it as a reality TV show, is clever, but I don't think it's going to be sustainable. Why? What makes a good reality TV show? Tension, conflict, difficulty, all the things you're wanting to avoid if you're going to Mars."
That's true. Exactly.
Then this person goes on to say, "The one thing we know about reality TV ratings is they go down over time, so broadcasters lose interest. Who's going to keep those people alive? The technology won't be ready for them to be self-sustainable for quite some time. So what if the show's canceled? Is somebody going to cough up $2 billion to save four people? What if the astronauts decide to turn off the cameras?" This is more less technical, Mal, and more sort of human psychology of, you know, what you do with those folks and what happens if they change their minds or they get into trouble or people lose interest and shut it off.
There is kind of a precedent for that. Even as early as Apollo 13, we had been to the moon on Apollo 11. And everybody got really excited, worldwide attention, and all that. That's great. All right. Along comes Apollo 12. It says, "Oh, yeah, well, we've seen that. They've already done that." And then, of course, 13 got out there, and nobody paid attention to it. They were doing feeds back from the space capsule back to home. They always did that on their trips. And then, of course, suddenly they had their little explosion and a problem, and now there's worldwide attention. So just what you were talking about, the tension, the problems that they arrive with, you got to have some drama included in a flight like that if you're going to have somebody paying attention to it on a regular basis.
All right. Well,
people's lives are too important to risk on a reality format, I think.
Right.
Okay. I think we'll be talking about this in the future. It's really interesting. Coming up, though, we're going to talk about Pluto, the favorite former planet of a lot of folks, as a space probe drawing closer and closer. Also, some mysterious gleaming white spots from the dwarf planet Ceres. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with our sky guys, catching up on some of the latest news in astronomy. And there's a lot to catch up on. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, in just a minute, I want to ask you about a space probe, again, drawing closer to the former planet Pluto, and John G. and Fortier, those mysterious glowing white spots from the dwarf planet Ceres. So I want to ask you about that in a moment. But here's an email from Don on our conversation about Mars and the possible mission there. Don says, "Mars trip not possible because of near fatal cosmic and solar radiation dose unless the crew vehicle is heavily shielded." Donald says, "Putting this into common terms, an astrobiologist said one half of the crew will need a bone marrow transplant upon arrival at Mars." Who wants to tackle that? That space radiation, John, is a serious health issue.
Oh, it's a huge issue that doesn't have a good solution right now. When you go to the moon, when you go into the space International Space Station, or when you're protected from the Earth's magnetic field that shunts those, it protects you from charged particles from the sun. The atmosphere on Earth protects us from many different forms of radiation, gamma rays, X-rays, most ultraviolet rays. But when you're in interplanetary space on your way to Mars, you're on your own. Solar outbursts, coronal mass ejections, flares, just the ambient external radiation coming from interstellar space, that is a huge hazard. And he's right. It's a hazard that must be dealt with appropriately from an engineering and technical perspective. So it's a threat.
Don, thank you very much for the email. You can email us as well. It's exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Email, again, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Mal, I wanted to ask you about everybody's favorite former planet, poor Pluto, demoted about a decade ago. Some people still love it, but still getting attention from a spacecraft called New Horizons. And this is getting pretty exciting.
Very exciting. Remember back in the Well, actually, it started in the 70s when they launched the Voyager probes, and Voyager 2 did what was called the Grand Tour. It flew out to look at the four planets beyond Mars. So it looked at Jupiter and then Saturn, as did Voyager 1. But Voyager 1 then took a turn and headed out into space. Voyager 2 continued to go on to Uranus and to Neptune. And it could do that because if you look at the way the orbits of the planets work around the sun, the orbits are almost just about within a degree or so in the same plane out from the sun. If you do a straight line out from the sun toward Neptune, you would bump into the orbits of all the other planets, but not Pluto, because Pluto's orbit has a 17-degree tilt off that axis.
So it's a weird and sort of
so
lopsided.
So in order to get there, you have to either fly down or below or up above that plane.
I see. So it's a little harder to get something there.
Right. So with New Horizons, it was designed specifically to look at Pluto. And as you said, in January of 2006, when it was first launched, they were going to a planet, the ninth planet. But unfortunately,
a little more cachet, huh?
Just a few months later, in August, on August the 24th, to be specific, of 2006, the International Astronomical Union, who is they set the rules for this sort of thing. And of course, we really think that there was a political thing behind all this, but we don't know. But they decided that they know that Pluto is sitting it was the first object discovered in what we now call the Kuiper Belt, which is out beyond the orbit of Neptune. And some of it even spills in towards Neptune. But they realized that it was sitting in a bunch of objects, they said, well, this is kind of like Ceres being in the midst of an asteroid belt. You know, we can't really call it a planet. So they redefined what a planet would be and found out, according to their new definition, Pluto just doesn't cut it. We cannot call it a separate planet, but we can call it a new category. We'll call it a dwarf planet. In the meantime, by the way, they also gave it an asteroid number. Its official number is 134340, but we don't want to call it that. So,
what has New Horizons found so far? It's getting closer and closer.
It's getting closer. It has found, we know that there's an ice cap on Pluto. We know that.
So water.
Yes, there is even a little atmosphere, depending. It does vary its distance from Pluto. It's closest to us was back in late 90s, I believe, John,
yes.
Somewhere in there. And now it's working its way back out again. It has a very elliptical orbit to it. And we do know a few things already about Pluto that was not discovered quite by New Horizons. One of the first things they discovered about Pluto was in late 1978, I believe it was, they discovered its largest moon called Charon. And it's an unusual moon because as Pluto spins, the moon keeps up with that spin. The moon is always over one spot on Pluto. If you could stand on Pluto directly underneath Charon, it would never disappear from view.
Wow.
If you're on the other side of Pluto, you would never know it exists.
What moon?
What moon?
But, John was on the other side when he was visiting.
There's no moon there.
But compared to the mass or the size of Pluto, this moon is very massive, much bigger than the moon we have compared to the Earth.
So Pluto's way, way, way out there in
way
the Kuiper Belt, closer in the asteroid belt, right? Sort of in the neighborhood of Mars, John
yep.
G. and 40.
Yep.
There's another dwarf planet, Ceres. Is it officially a dwarf planet or is it just an extra large chunk?
It is. It was and still is an asteroid, but it is in the five dwarf planet category.
Okay.
So Ceres is a dwarf planet.
So the dwarf planet Ceres has some mysterious glowing white spots. And we've been having some fun speculating about what these might be. But what does it look like, John?
Well, this is the year of the dwarf planet, it seems. New Horizons exploring Pluto, which is a dwarf planet. And the NASA mission Dawn is visiting its second asteroid, first Vesta, on the inner portion of the asteroid belt, and now Ceres, the first asteroid that was discovered in 1801, the largest asteroid. And as the Dawn mission approached series, it noticed a bright spot, or what we thought was a bright spot. But as the spacecraft got closer and closer, there turned out to be more bright spots, seemingly in the center of a large crater on the dwarf planet.
Kind of glowing, right?
Yeah, and now the Dawn mission is actually in orbit about Ceres, and in the next 4 or 5 days, we'll drop to its lowest distance to the planet in a science orbit, only about 2,700 miles above the surface of Ceres.
It's not going to land on Ceres like a Mars rover, though.
No, does not have that capability. But it's orbiting pretty close to get very high-resolution images. And these lights, I call them stadium lights, because my theory is that there's lots of water in the outer asteroid belt where Ceres is, so they play hockey there. So you have to have a stadium to play hockey.
Well, wait a minute. Maybe it's FIFA. They might have something going on up there we don't know about.
But we don't know. It's probably water ice. Breaking through the surface, perhaps a new impact crater exposed some underlying ice, and it hasn't sublimated away yet. But certainly all eyes and instruments are focused on this to find out exactly what it is.
Wow. Well, speaking of ice, I want to ask both of you guys about Europa. Lots of interest there. Lots and lots and lots. And Europa, if you're not familiar, that's a moon of Jupiter. But I also want to remind our listeners that you can join our conversation. We're talking with our sky guys today. There's been so much to catch up on in the world of astronomy. We brought them in. We're looking at some of the big headlines in space science. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. And by the way, guys, one of you mentioned earlier that 7 minutes of terror about the Curiosity landing on Mars. Mm-hmm. We'll put that link up on our website, nhpr.org. Okay.
Could I just interject something about Pluto? This Pluto flyby, by the way, is happening next month in July. So on July the 14th in the morning. And it is a flyby. It's not going to orbit the planet. It'd be next to impossible to do that at this distance with such a small object. So it's a flyby. Get as many pictures as you can.
Wow.
And move on into the Kuiper Belt.
Take as many selfies as you can while you're there.
Exactly.
All right. Here's an email from Wendy on our earlier conversation about Mars. She says, consider the number of people who volunteered for effectively one-way missions to the New World. The first mission to Mars, and probably long-term missions to the moon, should be considered as similar to that. Effectively one way, in the case of Mars, yes. Communication is cut off for much of the year. It's not a deal-breaker for some people. So I love that historical note, Wendy. Thank you so much. People who left, you know, England to come to New England back way, way, way back when. Sure, they weren't certain what was going to be here, and they certainly knew they wouldn't be communicating with family for a long, long time. So thank you for the email. Let's talk about Europa, gentlemen. Ice. Mm-hmm. People are really excited. Just remind us why Europa always gets space scientists excited, Mal Cameron.
Europa is one of the smoothest objects in the solar system. And back in the late 90s and early part of 2000, whatever, there was a probe called the Galileo mission, which was orbiting around, spent several years orbiting around Jupiter, and in particular got some close-up views of Europa and discovered it's completely ice-covered.
And there totally. Were, 100%.
Totally. And these ice, there were ice chunks in there that were obviously had broken off and moved around and twisted a little bit like an iceberg would do. This process was called rafting. And so they realized there's something liquidish underneath the surface. And upon further studies and extrapolating from what they're observing, they've discovered Europa has an extremely deep saltwater ocean underneath that ice. So the concept is, let's find out, wouldn't it be cool if there's a lot of water there and salt water? We have detected some organic materials there. There's a good possibility that there is something alive there. Now, it could be just bacteria or whatever. We're not sure, but we want to find out more about it. It's a very intriguing object being so far away, 500 million miles from the sun compared to us. And the new probe they're working on, they haven't named the mission specifically with a fancy acronym at all, but they have collected some detector materials, you know, some instruments that they want to put on this as they develop it. But the idea will be somewhere down the road in the next maybe 6 or 8 years, they hope to get this probe to orbit around Jupiter again, but do more flybys of Europa.
Now, Europa sounds incredibly interesting, given what we know about the potential for life from ocean water. I mean, you know, so much of the life on Earth, right, John, emerged from the ocean. That's what we're all taught in school. So why not send one of those cool little rovers down to Europa and have it, you know, put ice skates on it and have it scoot around the surface?
Well, I'm sure that mission scientists would love to do that. But I think they're gonna want to, in order to make a successful mission to Europa, you got to find out where the ice is thin. And that's what the European Space Agency and other space agencies have a huge interest in Europa right now.
So why thin?
Well, so that you can break through and get into the liquid water.
Get into the ocean. Okay.
And now, maybe you're wondering why a moon's a location so far from the sun, where the surface of Europa is 206 degrees Fahrenheit below zero, how could there be any liquid water there?
Right.
Well, there's Europa is a big enough moon for it to have a warm core, perhaps a semi-molten core, smaller version but somewhat similar to the Earth, that could generate some internal heat. Plus, Europa orbits Jupiter between some big moons and Jupiter itself, the most massive planet in the solar system. So the gravitational tides on Europa generate, write this down, one with 13 zeros after it, watts of thermal energy to keep that water liquid. Plus, if it's salty, which we've determined that that water is salty, that lowers the freezing point of water.
So there are other forces besides proximity to the sun that help something stay warm.
Yes, and this is teaching us about the flaw of thinking that life could only exist in the habitable or Goldilocks zone around a planet.
It's just life as we know it.
Exactly. So here we have a planet five times further from the sun than the Earth, with a cold environment at the surface, but it might be warm and cozy in the liquid water oceans. And that's what we want to do. We want to use the next couple of missions to Europa to find the places where heat is escaping. That would tell us where the ice is thin. That would tell us where to go, where we'd find more cracks to have access to this liquid water to send a probe. Plus, we have to make sure that the probe we send there is sterilized. Certainly don't want to pollute the environment on Europa with Earth bugs, which is a big concern for astrobiologists.
Well, yeah, and if there's some sort of bacterial life there or whatever, who knows what that could be?
Doesn't Europa belong to them?
Well, before we close out, gentlemen, I do have to ask you, Mal. Space scientists said, happy birthday to Hubble, 25 years old back in April. People
right.
say that Hubble has changed our view of the cosmos, our understanding of just our place in the solar system. What has Hubble contributed? What do you think?
Wow.
Yeah.
How much time left do we have?
Yeah, not much.
You have 30 seconds, man.
Yeah. It was launched on April 24th, 1990, put into orbit. So, yes, this is 25 years plus down the road. There have been five trips to it since it was put into orbit. The first one was to basically fix the mirror that was a little out of whack, but they certainly resolved that problem. And the last one was in 2009, where they just kind of left it to its own devices, if you will. And it's been still sending back some fantastic things. It's traveled some statistics, if you want a few. It's traveled over 3.4 billion miles in its journey in orbit. 1.2 million, there we go. It's looked at 38,000 objects, and it's also to help determine how old our whole universe is by looking at some of the furthest objects ever detected by any instrument, over 13 billion light years away.
All right. Beautifully put and set to music.
Whoa.
Thank you so much, guys. Lots to follow up on the next time we sit down and talk, but thank you so much for being here today. Mal, great to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Laura.
Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. John Gianforte, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Laura.
John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and astronomy instructor for UNH and Granite State College. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer this week is David Darman. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our theme music is normally composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes for NHPR Exchange.